whoa, there we are in the place to be.
Hi and welcome to What's Next. I'm Therese, your host, and I was trained to be an architect, I work as an architect, and I started this podcast to talk about what's next in the fields of architecture, design and technology, facing topics such as climate change, artificial intelligence, and where humanity's place is in this fast-moving world. I hope you enjoy this week's episode, so have fun listening.
Good evening. Thank you so much that you said yes to be on the show. How are you?
Oh, I'm okay. Thanks very much for the invite. Yeah, it was unexpected and nice, I guess.
Yes, I found you. I saw your website and I thought, why not? Looks nice. The first question would be, who are you? Please introduce yourself in the studio.
Okay. My name is David McGuinness from Gann Architects. There's two of us in the practice, myself and my wife, Bonnie Chow, and we're currently based between Ireland and Hong Kong, although we haven't been in Hong Kong recently due to the pandemic. We're quite new. We've been going for a year and a half, and mostly we've been working with existing buildings, mainly houses, and doing very small things with them.
Ireland and Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing in Hong Kong?
We have a small apartment renovation for a family member of Bonnie's.
Ah, so parts of your family is in Hong Kong.
My wife's family live in Hong Kong.
But that's a really great opportunity. So
it is.
Let's see.
Yeah, we'll have to get over and have a look at it.
Before we get into your work deeper, I have some small warm-up questions, a little bit more in the private section. And the first one would be, what's your favorite drink? Alcoholic, non-alcoholic?
It's probably coffee. I drink an awful lot of coffee. I think most people would have said that.
Actually, no.
Oh, okay.
So no alcoholic drink, no beer after work when you come home, no?
I'd have the odd small glass of whiskey, but very rarely.
Of course. You're from Ireland, no?
That's true.
If you could develop a skill overnight, what would you wish for? It can be anything.
I guess if patience is a skill, I'd like to develop that, or at least an ability to relax or wait a wee bit better. I'm not particularly patient or good at switching off, so I suppose that would be it.
Ah, so inner impatience and to switch your head off.
Mm.
Yeah, it would be nice, no?
Yeah.
All those sleepless nights just vanish.
That would be good.
What's your favorite hobby besides architecture?
I suppose it's relatively related to architecture. I quite enjoy woodworking, furniture making and the like. But I suppose away from architecture, more so would be I quite like walking, you know, hill walking and such. We live, we're lucky enough in Ireland where we live, it's in the countryside and we're quite close to some very short hills that we can walk up at our leisure.
That sounds really idyllic. Are there castles that you can see?
There's two. There's one that's a ruin and there's one that's been ruined by a renovation project. It's turned into a hotel.
Yeah, I was about to ask. I always wanted to go to Ireland and stay a couple of nights in a real castle.
Oh, yeah, you can do that.
Like I see in the movies all the time. Yeah.
I think there's quite a few to accommodate you.
Perfect. So you're a really young architecture office. You and your wife, you do it together.
Mm-hmm.
What's your philosophy? Or do you have not yet a philosophy? Or what is the red line if we look at your projects?
Currently, it's I think it's adaption. There's a couple of strands to that. All of our projects have been adaptions of an existing building, something that needs a bit of work. And then adapting to certain constraints as they appear along the project, like clients losing interest, clients changing their mind, budgets getting stretched and stretched further, or products becoming non-available due to political decisions made by some higher-ups in England. That type of thing. So it's basically we play a game of working with what we've been given and then trying to steer our intention through all of that minefield without losing too much of what we think is nice about it.
And how do you start? So someone comes to you and says, hey, I want a renovation project. How do you start? Do you have to go for a walk in nature to think about it? Or you and your wife, you lock yourselves into a small, tiny room separate from each other, and then you make your drawings and then you get back together? Or how does it work?
No, well, it's neither. Both of those things sound nice, but we don't do either. oftentimes it starts with we draw the site and the building in quite a detailed manner to get to the bottom of what's nice about it. It's a lot of what we do is about finding something that's some sort of hidden potential or something that could be surprisingly nice about the place. The wider place. The buildings oftentimes are terrible, and we just accept that. But we look wider than that. Like the orientation is sometimes quite good, or oftentimes it's quite bad. And we have the opportunity to, through the drawing exercise, we have the opportunity to find that and then elaborate on it to make a slightly overly designed skylight or something that we enjoy, and the client then doesn't expect until it's there. They get this surprise when they go on site and be like, "What's that thing?" Which I like, but basically we start the process by drawing everything.
And do you do a little modeling also out of cardboard?
We do later on. For me at least, I think Bonnie thinks better in the three dimension. When the model's made or something like that. I find it easier to just work through it very quickly with very rough, loose sketches. And we produce a lot of those to get to something.
And what happens if your client says, sorry, no, I imagine it completely different. This is absolutely not what I expected from you.
Normally, within reason, we go and do another option. But often that hasn't happened. We have a couple of options that we don't like so much that we show them at the same time that are worse, and we point out why they're worse. That sort of makes it look like we've thought a wee bit about it, and they generally accept our analysis as to why the option that we prefer is the best one.
I understand. And what happens if the opinions go really far from each other? The client has one and you have one. How far can you adapt to the client's imagination? To what's the point where you say, no, sorry, we cannot do this. I just can't.
Well, for me, it's generally when they start talking about glass handrails and things like that, I lose interest. or if they have a very elaborate kitchen without really considering you know, some slightly more important things like insulation or what type of windows and stuff you're putting in like that. But yeah, glass handrails and frivolous items I don't have much time for. But it can happen quite quickly, you know. Like particularly if a client comes with a scheme sketched out, we generally don't go with it we generally don't go forward with that client because, well, it's difficult.
And how do you handle those situations? If you could give young officers some suggestions how to handle those situations, what would you tell them?
I mean, it's very good to talk, you know, meet the client first, and we purposely don't do free consultations. You know, we don't talk about a project with anybody without charging at least something, because we find that it focuses their mind a wee bit better and you get rid of the people just testing the waters. And if a client's willing to pay for our opinion or our time at the start, they're generally more willing to listen to our ideas later on and less likely to come back with a request for a giant chandelier just as you're about to start on site or something like that. And we often, similarly, on the same vein, if they aren't willing to pay for it at the start, they generally aren't interested, and you're really interested in what you have to say. So it's a good way of weeding out those potentially problematic clients at the start.
Okay. And then, if you start, is there someone or something that inspires you? Do you go to a museum and you sit there for hours and look at a painting, or...?
It's a whole host of things. Generally, like, we're quite interested in small things and the finer, you know, the details and the construction and stuff like that. So generally we, you know, there might be an idea from one of us or the site, or, you know, something we see on site or about the material or a finish or how something has weathered. And we would use that as our starting point. And we'd work backwards from that detail and figure out how to construct that. So I suppose it's similar, you know, in the same vein, there's a lot of the stuff that, a lot of the work by Peter Zumter is quite inspirational in the way the weathering details and everything else like that are handled. I worked for a while with Clancy Moore in Dublin, a much more established practice than us. So there's always that, the previous work of those guys in the back of my head, which has probably been inspiration as well.
So you would also suggest young officers to first work somewhere in a nice office that can teach you a lot of things before you get started on your own right away?
Yeah, you'd have to, otherwise you'd be lost.
Clear words. What means being an architect for you? Do you have any responsibilities that you would like to present to the world?
I have a slightly pessimistic answer in mind, and I'm unsure whether to give it or not.
No, but please, I love pessimistic answers.
You know, we're quite, at least in the UK and Ireland, I find we're sometimes very undervalued and underappreciated as a profession. You know, we've been given an awful lot of, we take on an awful lot of risk, or we're expected to take on an awful lot of risk in terms of insurance and responsibility and everything else like that. And then we're often underpaid for that amount of risk, and particularly the amount of work it involves, and that, you know, it affects all of us at those higher up in larger commercial practices, as well as those working for those commercial practices, and then us at the very bottom have a particularly hard time because we can't get any of the bigger jobs anyway. I think perhaps there's a, and then as part of that, we're also in the UK at least, our regulatory position is quite tough compared to some of the professions who have taken some of the some of the work from us, you know, so for the likes of project managers and things like that who sort of eat away at our control over a project, or at least our fee, if you know what I mean.
But do you think project managers are capable of doing our job?
I think they're capable of doing a different job. I think without us, I mean, it's normally the architect or the architecture practice who's the one chasing the mechanical engineer when the duct goes through a door and or a window instead of where it's supposed to go and things like that. It's very rarely the project or design manager or somebody with a fancier title. You know, the less pessimistic answer would have been it's quite a lot of hard work, but at the end it's sometimes quite rewarding when you see the project and the clients are happy with it. I mean, I imagine it's very rewarding when you can, if you do something that has a slightly higher social capital, you know, like a project in social housing or some sort of public building. But we haven't worked on many of those, so that's the dream, I suppose, to see if that is more rewarding.
Is that your main topic, the happiness of your clients?
No, no, it's not. It's not. I mean, it's nice when they're happy, but we're more interested in getting a project that we have an interest in. You know, there's something, some sort of idea that we can explore that'll generate something else further on. Like, for example, we've done a project. It never went any further because of budget problems and things like that. But we have a project where we got an existing warehouse and we're tasked with fitting it out as an office and providing an extension and things like that. You know, they needed a few extra office rooms. And they had a project that was quite expensive previously that was like tear the thing down and build more. But working with the existing section, we took out the suspended ceilings and made some nice naturally lit and naturally ventilated communal rooms, which freed up more plan space for the office space within that. And then I suppose the idea from that was carried through to a couple of other projects where we've worked entirely within the found space of the roof because of the way sort of boom time bungalows were made in Ireland. They were typically dormer bungalows with a very wasteful and very badly arranged roof structure. So we've, in another couple of projects, we've used that space to pull light and stuff and solve some plan issues. So we're looking for projects that give us the scope to do things like, to play with things that we're interested in, which is namely construction and light, if you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. And if we are talking about light, natural ventilation, my next question would be, in terms of the climate crisis, how important is nature in your projects?
it's quite important. You know, we recently completed an introductory course to architectural conservation, and part of that highlighted the natural ways that those buildings of a certain age worked thermally and hydroscopically, with water and things like that. And I suppose it highlighted to us, at least, that there is a way around. There is a way to work with how materials work naturally. Like, it's like timber and stuff is timber, wood fiber insulation, things like that are breathable. And there is ways of keeping water out of things that don't require the plastic membranes and things like that. So we're interested in working with, I suppose, natural processes to eliminate superfluous plastic and, you know, all the additional layers that get pulled into construction at the moment, or pulled into building things at the moment. So it becomes about building simply, as opposed to, well, yeah, it becomes about building simply as a means to be more kind to nature.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because all the buildings get smarter and smarter, and on the same at the same time they get even dumber. Mm. Is it hard to follow a way where you would like to reduce technology in your buildings? Or are your clients like, no, I need air conditioning, I need this, I need this?
Some are, but most are happy to not, you know, because the mechanical aspect is quite expensive. So when you're doing a small project, it's either have the mechanical heat recovery system or, you know, the mechanical ventilation, or put an extra bit of money into the having a nice window system and things like that. And if you can, you know, when you can get the calculation to work, you know, if you can prove that your naturally ventilated building is going to ventilate adequately, they're usually more than happy to go with the, they're usually quite happy to take the benefit of getting the nicer window system or nicer floor material and things like that.
Also, if you compare this now to the project in Hong Kong?
Oh, well, in that one, we don't really have much choice. I don't think we could convince many clients to forgo their air conditioning in Hong Kong just yet. It's within the building, you know, given it's an apartment building, quite a tall tower that we're fitting out one unit in. So there's other constraints with building management that requires certain things that, you know, certain things are in there, and we have very little say on how the rest of the building is constructed. So, you know, we can't change the windows or anything like that. So it's we're stuck with what we have, what we've been given.
And when are you planning on going there to visit or to start?
We're going in early in the new year.
So Christmas and New Year in Ireland, and then off to Hong Kong.
Yeah, for a while, anyway.
For months or a year, or
not a year. We have some projects on site in Ireland that we can't ignore for that long. So it'll be probably a month at least.
And if we take a look into the future, how do you imagine the future living and working space? Like 50 years from now, do you think we're still sitting in offices and then we go home at 6 or 7 p.m.? Or do you think we travel around the world and we just have our laptops and everybody accepts it? Or are we not working at all because artificial intelligence is working for us and we just sit at home and get a basic paycheck every month?
I think if we had the latter, you know, the last option there, I'd probably still have an office to make models of funny skylights. But I don't think we can, you know, the traveling, and it may sound a bit hypocritical to say that I work between Hong Kong and Ireland, but I think that the traveling, the globe trotting nature of it is probably, unless there's some major breakthrough in air travel, it'll probably become either prohibitively expensive or totally unethical in terms of the amount of, you know, emissions that come out of it. So I suspect the globe-trotting nature of it isn't quite there. But in saying that, I do think there's always going to be a role for an office, although they'll be significantly smaller, and I suspect a lot more flexible. You know, there'll be a lot more of these co-working spaces, I suppose, you know, where you can go if you want, or you can, but it is hard to get past the, you know, the collective, you know, particularly like there's only the two of us in the practice at the minute, so it's very easy, and we share a big long desk, so it's very easy to turn around to Bonnie and say and ask a question whenever I'm stuck on something or something's a bit daft, you know, if I think something's getting a bit deaf because I've locked it for too long. And I suspect that translates to every other bit of work in the same manner. So it's hard to see offices going completely, if that makes a very roundabout way of saying it's probably going to be very similar to the same, with houses being smaller because nobody can afford them.
Okay, and the living space, houses get smaller. Do you think we will just sit there with our Oculus Rift glasses and we create our avatar and we have just like 8 square meters in a concrete box? Or how do we live? And we're not leaving that tower of concrete anymore.
No, I don't think so. I think houses, you know, there might well be more the density will have to rise, obviously, because everybody's going to be, there'll be more city living, I suspect, because, you know, the way the trends are going. But I don't think it'll be concrete. I think hopefully it'll be something like timber, I suppose, you know, because it's a wee bit more green. But I suppose, you know, where am I going with this answer? It's a very difficult question, this one.
I will interrupt and I will ask you my favorite question. Have you seen the movie Ready Player One?
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Like this, exactly like this. Do you think this is happening not in 50 years, but maybe in 100 years? Can you imagine that we as a human race go that low?
Probably. I mean, anything's possible. There's no reason. You know, I'm sure some people would quite enjoy that, you know, if it was like that. I can't say I would, and I hope it isn't, as much as I can say on that. As much as did I enjoy the movie? Not really, but I don't think I'd like it to be like that.
No, it was, for me, it put a slightly depressive mode here at home. I honestly don't know. I think we can adapt to a lot of things, so we can also adapt to this way of living. Who knows?
I think you're probably right. I hope it's not. I hope it's. I hope we have a lot more air about where we live. You know, more space, like both outside and inside. I think you can design. You can, as you say, you can adapt to it. But I'd like the world in the future to have a lot more green space between where we live. If you know what I mean.
Wait, with this, the next question would be, if you had to paint me a picture of your perfect vision of the future, how would you paint it? What would I see?
Well, the black white sheet's better than the Ready Player One dystopia, no? That's a good question.
So you mentioned a lot more green?
Green. And green with timber buildings. Green timber buildings, interspersed with whatever is existing, you know, because we probably shouldn't be building with more concrete.
Do we still have zoos?
Zoos? Mm-hmm. Only those that are important for conservation exercises.
Then? Already last question. What means architecture to you personally? You said a lot of different things, but if you could sum it up, what does it mean for you personally?
I was talking to Bonnie earlier, but before this, about the, you know, going through the questions, you know, see if she had any bright ideas for any of the answers. And We watched a movie recently on Netflix, Jonah Hill one, where he talks to his therapist.
I saw the trailer. I wanted to watch this. Is it depressing?
It's not depressing, no. I didn't think so. It was, you know, it was mildly entertaining, and it was quite, you know, there's some nice shots and things in it. But your man, the therapist, has the saying about life, and it's always three things. So there's pain, uncertainty, and constant work. And that was Bonnie's suggestion for what architecture means to us. But you know, I think it's a bit dark. I mean, it's true in one aspect, but you know, from the constant work, you know, that's there's something nice about that, in that it you always have something to do and something to occupy yourself with, and you know, there's always something driving you forward. You know, the idea, I suppose, the idea of the constant work is that you're always interested in it, and you know, it's better to be working at something that you like. You know, if you like what you do, you don't work a day in your life. That type of thing, I suppose, is where I see that niceness. And the uncertainty is, again, there's a nice surprise to it. You know, so you get surprised by. I find often that I'm walking around it doesn't have to be a very nice town, but like I the closest city to where we live is called Newry. You've never heard of it. It's a very small town in Ireland, and it's been very badly treated over the years. But coming, you know, that idea of uncertainty is often, you don't know what you like until you see it, and I'm often very pleasantly surprised by very nice fragments of things that haven't been completely destroyed, you know. So I don't think, you know, and they're always in buildings or something that's built, so uncertain, that uncertainty is a nice surprise sometimes, is what I'm trying to get at. And the pain, I don't have much of a silver lining for, so I'll ignore it. But uncertainty and constant work, or surprise and constant interest, or constant development, is that better?
Yeah, but actually that sums it up really nice, no?
I guess so, yeah.
It was all a little...
pessimistic.
Dark, but then you turned it back around the wheel, and now we finish with a light and nice summation of what means architecture for you. Then, David, thank you so much for your time. It was a great interview, and it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you. It was quite fun, really.
This was this week's episode. We really hope you liked it as much as we did. If you have comments, suggestions, critique, please let us know. And till next time on What's Next. Ciao, ciao!